I'd like to invite our three speakers back up just to have a short discussion prior to going out into a wrap-up consensus session at the end. David.
Thank you. Jorgen, we haven't met. David Katz from Yale. You seem to appreciate blunt speaking, right? So I hope I can be an honorary Dane. And point out that your question about nutrition is entirely specious. And here's what I mean. We could have an international standard for bulletproof vests because bullets hurt everybody and a vest that stops them is an effective vest. We couldn't possibly have an international standard for all aspects of wardrobe because some people are trying to dress to shield them from cold and some people are trying to dress to shield them from heat. And so we have to culturally tailor that. Whereas we can define the variations on the theme of healthful eating, we can have international standards for nutrition quality at the level of foods because, for example, you and I probably get too little omega-3 in our diets, but Inuits get too much. And whereas calories tend to be in excess in Western countries, there are places in the world where they're still deficient, and energy density would actually be a good thing. If anything, in the U.S. and Canada, we tend to consume too much protein. There are places around the world, Horn of Africa, where they consume too little. So we can define optimal nutrition. What we can't define globally is the discrepancy between your current dietary pattern and optimal nutrition, because that discrepancy is geopolitically variable and very much culture-bound. And we actually had this discussion when we were developing the Anki algorithm. This is a measure of overall nutritional quality for whom? And the answer was for just about all of Western Europe, for certainly for the U.S. and Canada, for countries undergoing a cultural transition so that they are starting to experience new age epidemiology. But it's not for Bangladesh, and it's not for Somalia, because, frankly, the cultural context in which people are accessing their current diets is very variable. It's not lack of nutrition science, but there is no one-size-fits-all answer to move people to better nutrition. I think we could argue that cholera is bad for everybody. Calories aren't.
But I think what I'm trying to say is that what we have learned the hard way in the food safety area is to separate the science about what is dangerous and what is not. That's the science and the levels that you have to reach so that something is not dangerous. From the management in relation to how you deal with that issue. And again, just like in nutrition, you have very different contamination patterns in different parts of the world. So dealing with the issue will be different from country to country. So you don't necessarily have one fits all for dealing with the issue, but you should have a global science in relation to nutrition and what is good nutrition. And do we have that? And do we have the clear, yeah, maybe you say yes, but the thing is, what I need is I need some clear definitions of what that is. And I need some clear prioritization, I think also, from nutritional side of what should be done. What are the five most important things to do in relation to nutrition? And do we have that agreement? No, but you're again mixing these two. Maybe it's also a Danish thing. I can only think about one thing at a time. Okay, so one is the science about what is the right nutrition, and the other one is how do you get there from wherever you are. So if you're here, you have to go down. If you're here, you have to go up. That's a different thing. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking only about this over here. Do we have that? That's my issue. And if you go to ordinary people, Joe, whatever you call him here on the street, he will tell you that he's mighty confused about all the different messages that he gets in relation to nutrition. And I think that that's a major problem in the nutrition area. He could also be mighty confused in the food safety area, but that, we don't talk about that now, because now we are attacking nutrition.
Ha ha ha.
Janet.
Janet Bovee, McGill University. I go to a lot of meetings, and I hear different things about the impact of standards on small local farmers in the developing world or on their local economies. On the one hand, you hear that standards cause a great cost burden, compliance burden for these smallholders, and forcing them to downgrade or exit the market into more informal types of markets in their region. On the other hand, I was pleased to hear all three speakers talk about the opportunity for farmers and producers in small countries to use standards as an opportunity to innovate, upgrade, gain investment, and to mature their markets. Can you tell us what fora we could use to have a dialogue, to have a more fulsome discussion about the impact of standards? Does it cause downgrading, move to informal market, or is it an opportunity for innovation? Because it doesn't seem to me that we have a natural forum. At the global level, we might talk in codex, but we don't have that type of dialogue. I don't know where we're having it, and I'd like to hear what would be a recommended fora.
I think you're absolutely right that there's a lot of concern that setting those standards and requiring them of local farmers is going to have a significant negative economic impact. Right now, that is front and center in the United States with regard to the pending food safety legislation, which is sitting with the Senate. There's a lot of media, a lot of press about local farmers saying we're going to be put out of business. You could engage with the pepper farmer in Mexico. That may be a greater challenge. I think there's plenty of folk right here, probably in Canada and certainly in the United States, who right now publicly are stating, if you apply standards to us, we're in trouble. And they would be the folk to engage with as to how to reach that. My personal perspective is that we have to apply standards to everybody who is putting food into the food chain from a food safety perspective. And anybody who claims that they can't afford to do that or they're too small to do that shouldn't be in the food they shouldn't be in the food business, frankly. So the question is how to apply it. So to me, there's two pieces of that. One is engage them on the fact that standards may well come down that's going to hit Dole and Fresh Express as much as it's going to hit the local spinach producer. But secondly, what are the tools to get them up to speed? And that's the part that I think we have not engaged on. What's the educational strategy? What are the specific needs that these people have that need to be focused to the small and possibly medium-sized business to make them successful from a food safety perspective? Rather than sort of saying, well, hey, you know, you just got to fish with everybody else. So, but I don't know what those are, Janet, and I think that would be the engagement. But I think you could do it well within North America because they're already screaming that they can't do it.
Mary Labbe, University of Toronto. Jorgen, I'm going to actually put you on the spot and challenge your notion that we don't have science for nutrition. And I'm actually going to put it that I think we have lots of science, but where we really fall down is in our risk management. And I guess I'm going to put it out to the panel here. Do we have the tools to manage the nutrition risks? I mean, we've spent a lot of efforts at WHO level, in Canada and U.S., doing our DRIs. You know, we have some nutritional requirements, and we know what they should be. But I say we don't have really good strategies of the risk management. How do we get the population from where they are now to where we want them to go? And so that's my sort of comment, and I guess it leads to my question is, do we have the proper and tools and policies for what I'd say is our population and our nutritional problems of the 21st century? And I mentioned this briefly earlier to you. We have policies and tools like Canada's Food Guide, Food Pyramid in the U.S., a number of other things, and those are risk management in a sense. Those are our processes that were really developed for the Depression in the 30s, feeding our population during the war. Are they the proper tools to be talking about obesity, a population that's overweight, lots of type 2 diabetes, and those become risk management problems, I challenge you, Jorgen, rather than knowing the science of what our nutrient requirements are. So I turn it over to the two panels, your comments on do we have the right tools for addressing our nutritional problems, and then if we don't, what would you think some of them should be?
I don't think that we have the right tools. I don't know that anyone have found the right tools. I think that there probably has to be a palette of different types of tools, and what the countries could do to help each other is actually to share the experiences where they have done something that works. But when I'm saying science, you know, so what is the story about sugar? What is the give me the science now? What's the story about sugar? Is it good or is it not good? Is it about sugar? Is it about the calories? What is it? Tell me.
Well, I won't give you my opinion. I will just cite experts.
So it's opinion. It's about opinion.
No, I'm saying scientists. The latest evidence that we've seen coming out of the Canada Community Health Survey actually said if you tried to deal with obesity, the analytical difference isn't in the choice of more sugar or more fat. It's actually more calories. We may be blaming it on sugar, but it's actually more calories. That's what our evidence says. I don't know if that's the answer you want.
Why has it taken so long to get there? Well, I can have long discussions in between you and me about why that is, because that is also interference of some of the industry that doesn't like the results that come out. That's very clear. But, you know, this is a relatively simple thing. This is a relatively simple thing. I'm sure that people have been working on this for 30 years. How can it take 30 years to come up with this? I am amazed.
Well, I'll say, what policies or levers or tools do we need then if we're really going to be, if our current ones aren't serving us well, what would we need for the future?
I don't have an answer to what tools do you need, but I think you're absolutely right that the tools we have are inadequate. You only got to look at the what we're doing to ourselves nutritionally to see that. We need to learn from the things that have worked, from the successes that we've had, which I think have been small relative to the size of the problem. There hasn't been a focus on this, and I think to Jürgen's point, that there hasn't been a clear scientific focus because the endpoint is so nebulous, and it's a huge challenge. And, you know, at FDA, the focus was 90% on food safety, 20% maybe, 15% on nutrition. Now, is that right? If you look at the rate of coronary artery disease and the complications from obesity, which are, quote, food-borne illnesses, if you really are broad in your terms, it far exceeds anything that you would see from Salmonella or E. coli. It's just that E. coli kills children. That's emotive. That's front-page New York Times stuff. Gets everybody fired up, gets Congress leaping in to fix the solutions, increase FDA's budget by $150 million. How much of that's going to nutrition? None of it. That's the problem, is that it's a slow burn that needs comprehensive thinking around social networking, our social media, how do you change behavior. It is orders of magnitude more complicated than food safety. Food safety is easy relative to what you've got to do.
Don't say that.
How are you, Guy with IBM again? David, a question for you just regarding standards, and I guess open it up to everyone if you want to comment, but just, and you sort of borrowed a little bit or stole my thunder a little bit in a good way, with a related sort of question. Do we have the right standards? So we need standards for food safety. Right. They need to be applicable to everyone in the food supply chain because of the complexity of the supply chain and the interconnectivity of the supply chain. But do we have the right standards? Are we measuring the right things? Are the standards actually guaranteeing food safety, or are they just so specifically targeted towards large processors and large industrial operations that by their very nature, they're biased against the smaller operators who don't have a big industrial processing facility?
I think in the United States, and let me speak from that perspective, and Jürgen can speak more globally than that, they have evolved to address that side of the food system is the large processors and the large suppliers, because typically standards and regulatory change reacts to problems, and that's where the problems have occurred, or at least that's where they've been perceived to have occurred or have been linked to, so that's where the fixes are. The challenge around standards is what's acceptable global standard, which obviously is a huge part of what Codex does, of trying to figure that out. The problem there is that process is slow, and I think there's many, many ways to reach that endpoint in terms of a standard. But that's only, frankly, the start of it. Where a standard has impact is applying it assuring that, that people understand what they have to do to maintain that standard, and actually to inspect them, regulate them to the point where they're actually doing it, so there are consequences when they don't meet that standard. So I don't think the challenge is that the standards are not there on a global basis. Yeah, on fresh produce, there isn't a requirement in FDA, in the United States, I should say, for standards at the farm level. But essentially, it's not a massive leap to take good agricultural practices, update them, and make them a requirement. We're not talking there about a lot of work. So the science is there to do it. And in many respects, that's the easy part. It's making them effective and understood at the local level that I see is a bigger challenge. But
is there a button that we're pressing over there? They're on already. Okay. I would say that the way that standards have moved, particularly along the food safety issues, have more and more emphasized the process dimension. How is food produced, right? I mean, I think that this is something that you certainly know very well, that we've moved from just looking at the final product. And the more that you emphasize processes of production, the more that you go down, right, to the farm level, to the producer level. And there, I would say that the problem isn't so much the issue of the size, the small, the large. The problem is what is the kind of support that you have in place to make the shifts that are necessary and the adjustments that are necessary in order to make the improvements and the upgrading that you have to have. And this is whether we're talking about food safety, whether we're talking about environmental standards, when you talk about eliminating pesticides that are dangerous and producers have been using for decades dangerous pesticides and you're trying to move away from that. Well, where is the support, let's say, for all new kinds of pest management control that is going to integrate different dimensions? The same thing is happening when you're talking about recycling methods. If all of these areas, the challenge is not so much, to me, when you're talking about developing countries or the poorer producers, is the support infrastructure, whether we're in this. What I mean by infrastructure is not so much the physical element, but where does the government, where do the NGOs, where do the local producers, the local associations, the large firms, and the universities, where, how does this get built up?
While you're on that point, on that point, because I missed that in your presentation about how the dairy farmer who was pouring the milk into the plastic jug then all of a sudden went to, you know, he's pouring it in stainless steel containers. There's a lab that he can go to. There is potable water now. There's electricity. How did that happen? Where did that transformation come from? Was that somebody like Grameen? Was that somebody like Danone who came in? And I know they do similar projects in Southeast Asia. How did that? I'd just be interested to hear how that happened.
Well, in this particular case, actually, you had a combination of EU programs. Along with local government programs, along with the local producers also organizing. So you had a combination of international organizations, local government, as well as local producers, because you're talking about major investments. As a group, their investments, although individually, making improvements can be an issue maybe of $500, $1,000, but for these producers who are poor, it's a difference between doing it or not doing it, right? The same with the lab. Who's setting up the labs and having local labs in areas where you have no professionals? You have nobody with the skills to be running these labs. And how do you engage in improving the training in universities? And actually, this is an area that I think has been neglected from the development side. There has been a lot of emphasis, and I want to connect this to this notion of science. If we look at the science and the if you mentioned the use of evidence and the generation of evidence. In developing countries, we need to move beyond just simply being the receivers of evidence to being producers of evidence. And in order to do that, you need to strengthen the universities. You need to strengthen the science department and all the different areas so that you can actually have the professionals who are going to be running whatever services are necessary, whether it's in terms of extension services, in agriculture, whether it's in the public health departments. And that is an area that has been neglected. What was interesting here is that they needed services along many areas in order to make the upgrading that was necessary to meet standards. And a local university was created, again, with multiple actors. And I think this gets back to the first question. Where are the fora, do you say? You know, who is going to participate? We need, I think, more diverse actors here from the government and non-government side to participate in the creation of those organizations that are necessary to make the shift. So in the case of the university, you had local people creating new departments in an area of the country that never had seen a university. But this was receiving foreign funding. It was receiving also government support, NGOs that have provided technical assistance as you were training the new people, you see? So this is what I mean by these local and global networks that get created, but through concrete activities.
Okay, we have one last question, because then we have to...
say to Jorgen that I really agreed with what you said. The reason is if you go to food companies and you ask them the science of Pepsi Cola or tomato soup, they look at you with a blank face. They do not know the relations between the variables under their control and either the sensory perceptions or the consumer reactions. Now, if these are companies whose very livelihood depends on a profound knowledge of their own products, if they themselves are not ready, willing, or able to understand the physics and the psychology of their own products, how do we expect government bodies to have any concept of nutritional policy when they're trying to put together disparate, different pieces of information from different laboratories at different times subject to different biases? I'm not at all surprised that there's no science of sugar, that there's no science of nutrition. It's impossible. You have no coherent grand view, and you may never have such a grand view.
But just to say, I'm a veterinarian. Maybe you can hear that in my simple language. I'm a veterinarian, and if you look at nutrition in relation to animals, there's a huge body of evidence. There's a huge research effort. There's lots of clear understanding of how you should feed animals. Then I'm still at a loss why we are still struggling in the dark in relation to how to feed ourselves.
If Fluffy were to make the purchasing decision rather than Fluffy's master, we may never come out with a science of nutrition.
I don't think that was the point.
That's not the point. The point is that the companies themselves not only don't know the nutrition, they don't even know the sensory pleasure of their own products. Ask a company that manufactures fruit juices, what's the optimum formulation of your fruit juice to maximize acceptance, and what are the two segments of users, and they'll look at you with a totally blank face. They depend on this knowledge, which they get by accident, to make money. If they don't even know their own business, how do we expect government bodies to know when they're a patchwork of information?
Okay, we're going to have to cut it off here because we have to come up with three priorities, but I think this is really important because as an economist who knows nothing about nutrition, my question has always been, how do we get that information? Is there some standard information for us to use in order to produce the right products and eat the right things? Mm-hmm.